offering my most loving pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet. Dear listeners, I welcome you to this week's episode of the Gita series, The Triune Pilgrimage. This is Prem, your friend from Team Radio Sai, and it is my pleasure to join you this week too as part of this pilgrimage as we go through and study in detail the shlokas of the Bhagavad Gita. We are in the third chapter, and the third chapter pretty much deals with Karma Yoga. And we are in that section where Krishna is talking about the importance of even a jnani acting. Like always, we'll begin with a short introduction based on the summary of the shlokas that we covered last time, so that we'll be able to continue with that, because it's a continuation of the discourse which Krishna is speaking. As I said, he gives himself as an example. We went through verses 23, 24 and 25. In verse number 22, he starts giving an example of himself. He says that I do not have anything to be gained from the three worlds. I am self-satisfied. I do not have any craving. There is nothing that anybody can give me. And in verse number 23, which we covered last week, he says that even though I am such a person who does not have anything to gain, I still act. And then in the verses that follow, he explains why he acts. He says that if he were to choose inaction, all the others would be very happy to follow. There are a lot of people who are unwise. We're going to talk about them today too. Krishna says that such people would be very happy to follow suit, would be very happy to look at Krishna and say that even we would refrain from action. One reminder which we've been seeing in the previous weeks, when we are referring to action and inaction, it should be always remembered that it is not about simply sitting without acting that we are referring to inaction. The reference here is doing your duty and giving up your duty. That is what is being constantly repeated and constantly referred to as action and inaction. The whole discussion is based on this question that Arjuna asks, or which is not completely expressed himself, but this question of, should I be bound by the duties and act, or can I give up all of these duties and choose a life in the forest? Choose a life of renunciation, choose a life of sannyasa. So whenever we are referring to the words action, inaction, I think we should keep in our mind that it is not about being active and being lethargic or inactive in that sense, though that also can be explained with some of these verses. But the whole idea or the undercurrent of this entire explanation is about doing one's duty because one is put in a certain situation, or does one have the choice of giving up that duty in the name of pursuit of the higher truth? So Krishna says that if in all his wisdom, he in one of the verses before that, before when he was speaking about a jnani in general, he says, for one who is wise, there is no difference between action and inaction. There is nothing for him to gain through action as much as there is nothing for him to gain through inaction. So Krishna says, he gives himself as an example and he says, when that is the case, but still I act, because if I don't act, people will look at me and say that look at this great jnani Krishna, look at this great avatar, and Swami says my life is my message, and this is the message that Swami gives, so let me follow that. And there is a reason why it is wrong to blindly follow even the avatar's actions. We've spoken about that even a couple of weeks ago, but we'll speak about that in detail, in a little bit of detail, in one of the verses that we're going to come to today. So Krishna says that people are already waiting for an opportunity to give up their duties. So if I were to do it, people will be more than pleased and more than happy to follow suit. In verse 25, Krishna says that just as after having given all of these explanations that this is why he acts, Krishna says in the last line of verse 24 that, in verse 24, Krishna says that the whole world would perish if he doesn't act. And to set an example to everyone, he acts. And we had a discussion last week about this particular statement that Krishna is making. It is more than just setting an example, and we saw some references from the Gita Vahini where Krishna is hinting at not only acting to be a role model for others, but acting that saying that if I do not act, the universe would perish is a hint at the fact that he is the inner motivator of the entire universe. So that's another different aspect of Krishna's divinity that he is revealing here. And that's in verse 24. So in verse 25, summarizing all of this, what Krishna had said so far about himself and about a jnani, he says, just as the ignorant act because of their attachment for action, the wise should act just the same way, but without such attachment. And we discussed what this means, because there they act with attachment, and here Krishna says you act without attachment, but just the same way. So what is that similarity which Krishna is referring to? And we had discussed how that is, what that means is, with a similar enthusiasm. And where will this enthusiasm come from? Krishna says, when you have an eye on the welfare of the world, when that is in your focus, when jnana is there, as Swami would so beautifully say, you should have the head of Shankara, which means the wisdom should be guiding every one of your actions, but you should have the hands of Janaka. We spoke about Janaka being an example a couple of weeks back, where you continue to act, and then Swami says you should have the heart of Buddha. And Swami would say the heart of Buddha means to have compassion for the people around. So that is what a complete personality is. It's not only the wisdom, it is not only the action, it is not only the detachment, but it is also acting with the welfare of the world in the mind, even though there is nothing, absolutely nothing to be gained for a wise one. So those are the verses we went through last week, 23, 24 and 25. We will go to verse number 26. As always, I have the recordings by Brother Shyam, one of our alumnus, who week after week we listen to the beautiful rendition of the Bhagavad Gita shlokas in his voice. We listen to that. I'll give you a very brief meaning after that, and then we will discuss in detail about that shloka.
Na buddhi bhedam janayet ajnanam karma sanginam joshayet sarva karmani vidvan yukta samacharan.
Let no wise man unsettle the mind of ignorant people who are attached to action. He should engage in all actions, himself fulfilling them with devotion. So this is verse number 26. Krishna is saying not only must one act and set an example for the others, but must also act so as to not to unsettle the minds of the ajnani. He says, buddhir bedam na janayet. Do not cause buddhi bedam, or the confusion of the mind, of whom ajnanam karma sanginam, those who are ignorant and those that are attached to action. In the second line he says, vidvan, the wise, yuktaha, one who is steadfast in that knowledge, joshayet sarva karmani, should engage in all actions, samacharan, performing them well, or performing them with that diligence. Why is Krishna saying that an ajnani should not be disturbed? This is very interesting. He says an ajnani should not be disturbed. Is he suggesting that a person who is foolish should be allowed to remain foolish? Is Krishna suggesting that someone who is lost should not be troubled with the facts and truth, and he should be allowed to be lost? Is that what Krishna is hinting at? No, that is why Krishna says, ajnanam karma sanginam. He says, it's not only about the ignorant, but one, those who are ignorant and who are attached to action, karma sangina. As we saw the last week, being attached to action is not merely being attached to the action, but to the consequence of the action. And this is a pointer at the nature of a person whom we are referring to, an ajnanam karma sanginam. Why is Krishna saying that a wise man should set an example for the unwise man, the part that we had seen so far? Because for an unwise man, to perform one's duty is important, right? That's what Krishna had made it categorically clear. what stops one from performing one's duty? We have Arjuna's example here. We have all our examples in our own lives when there are times when we are not able to pull ourselves up and enthuse ourselves to do what we are supposed to do. So what stops a person from performing one's duty? As Swami would often say in many of his discourses, we always have a choice between Shreyas and Preyas. I'm sure I've mentioned these two words before in the Gita series too, and it's going to come again many, many times hereafter. These are very, very two important words, a very important concept that Swami speaks about. Shreyas is the right path, which may or may not have an immediate good result. But you can be sure that the Shreyas is always the right path. Preyas is a path which will give you immediate benefit. And most often Preyas, Swami uses the word, for the wrong path which gives immediate benefit. So there are these two options which always present itself in front of us. Not necessarily always, but whenever we have a dilemma, it is always a choice that has to be made between Shreyas and Preyas. That which is right, which does not seem to be giving an immediate benefit, and that which is wrong, but there is an immediate benefit to be gained. The makeup of the mind is such that it always goes towards that where there is an immediate benefit, because the mind is always trying to do the best for itself, right? That's the very nature that's the very function of the mind. Choosing Shreyas does not necessarily always meaning there is no benefit, but the true benefit may come in a later time, right? That's how the nature of good acts themselves are. For example, you have a child who has an exam the next day. So there are these two choices before the child: either go out and play or sit and study. Going out and playing is going to give immediate pleasure and delight to the child, but sitting and studying will also give a benefit, but the benefit is a part of a larger scheme of things, and it will come over a period of time. So when you are going to counsel this child, or when you're going to teach this child what is the right thing to do, the child has to be trained to see the value of discriminating between Shreyas and Preyas and picking Shreyas. Right? That is what we have taught children to do. That's what we have learned ourselves over a period of time. When we choose honesty over dishonesty, when we choose speaking the truth over speaking lies, all of these are choices between Shreyas and Preyas, and this requires mental training to be able to choose something which does not give us immediate benefit over something which gives us immediate benefit, because the mind's instinct is to go towards something which gives instant benefit. As I mentioned a few times before, for every action there is a drishyafala, a seen result, and an adrishyafala, or an unseen result. So a common man is referred to by Krishna here as karma sangina, someone who has come to understand the value of doing the right action, or if we can call it shreyas karma, over the immediately beneficial action or preyas karma. He has not given up attachment towards the consequence of actions, but he has mentally trained himself to choose shreyas karma, or that which gives benefit over a longer period of time, over that which gives benefit immediately. So even though he has not given up his attachment to the consequence of the actions that he performs, this is a mental training that has happened over a period of time. Religion plays a very, very important role in that. Moral values that we teach our children play a very, very important value in that. When we listen to spiritual discourses, satsanga, all of this is actually training us to make this choice of Shreyas over Preyas. And through this path, we will eventually turn to Karma Yoga, and that will lead to Chitta Shuddhi. And as we have said, Chitta Shuddhi is that which prepares the mind to receive the wisdom, the state which is beyond karma, which we refer to as Naishkarmya. So this is the sequence. So a normal person is supposed to go through this sequence of training the mind to choose Shreyas over Preyas. Even though he has not given up his attachment to action, it is modified in this manner, and eventually it will lead to the path of Karma Yoga. So to such a person, if the idea that action is not necessary is given as it is, he would be happy to choose inaction. As I mentioned right in the beginning of the show, action, inaction, we are referring to duty and giving up duty, right? To be able to stick to one's duty, to be able to constantly do what is expected of us and the pressures that are pulling all around us is a challenge, is not something that we would naturally like to do, right? So a person, when he is given this idea of inaction in its purest form, he would be happy to choose inaction over action. But the problem is, in this case, inaction is a Preyas Karma and not a Shreyas Karma. I know I'm using the word karma and I'm saying inaction. It might be a little confusing, but let's probably say Preyas and Shreyas. I hope you're getting the drift of what I'm saying. So here is a jnani who has reached the state where action and inaction do not matter to him. And let's say he chooses inaction. Seeing that person give up all his duties and probably sitting and meditating, here I come along and I have this pressure of all these duties pulling me from all sides. And I look at it and I say, look, I want the wisdom that that person has. I want the peace of mind that that person has. What is he doing? Oh, he's not doing anything. So let me choose that. Now the choice is by not choosing action or not choosing to perform my duties becomes a easier path in front of me. So for me, to choose inaction becomes a choice that I'm making of Preyas over Shreyas, right? So the actionless state that a person has to achieve is actually beyond the ego, which is achieved by transcending this idea of what is going to benefit me, right? In other words, as I said, Shreyas and Preyas both has benefits. One has immediate benefit, one has a long-term benefit. One has a drishya phala, one has an adrishya phala. But the state of naishkarmya is got when one is able to transcend the idea that I want to benefit, right? So when we look, when Krishna says that, why is it wrong to set an example of inaction in front of a person who has not yet transcended the idea that I want to benefit, is when he chooses inaction, he is actually making the choice of Preyas over Shreyas, which is a wrong thing to do, because he has been mentally trained over many, many years to make this difficult choice of Shreyas over Preyas, and now he is being given this training to make the wrong choice, right? So when Krishna says buddhi vedam, it is the path of discrimination that must not be disrupted, right? When he says that the buddhi vedam, buddhi means the discriminating mind or the discrimination aspect of the mind, vedam is to disrupt it or to disturb it. So when he says buddhi vedam, it means this discrimination should not be disturbed, because it takes lifetimes for one to be able to choose Shreyas over Preyas in every situation that presents before it, right? And for a jnani for whom action and inaction is the same, the jnani might as well choose to do action as to help the others have this example in front of them to follow. A couple of days back, I was listening to this wonderful talk by one of the monks from the Ramakrishna Order, and the talk was on Ashtavakra Gita. And he was explaining how this Ashtavakra Gita, and those of you who are not familiar with the text, it is a dialogue between sage Ashtavakra, who is supposed to be a very, very great jnani, and King Janaka. And the discourse and discussion is of a very, very esoteric nature. It's on pure Advaita. That is because Janaka is also a very evolved sadhaka, and Ashtavakra is a great jnani. So the discussion is of such a high order that this particular text, which is referred to as Ashtavakra Gita, or the discourse of sage Ashtavakra, is referred to as a Nididhyasana text, which means it is only meant to be meditated upon, because each one of the statements are like a Mahavakya. Just like when you say Tat Tvam Asi, there is a discourse behind it. You know, why, how have they derived this idea that you and I are one, or thou art that, this conclusion, it is like thus proved of a long 6-page rider or an axiom which has been derived, right? So that is referred to as a Mahavakya. Tattvamasi or Aham Brahmasmi is referred to as a Mahavakya. A Mahavakya, when you're given the Mahavakya, it is only to be meditated upon and the knowledge will come from it. So that is what is referred to as something which is meant for Nididhyasana or meant for meditating upon. So this speaker was saying that the Ashtavakra Gita, the entire text is like a Nididhyasana text. It is only for meditation because much of the explanation is skipped because the disciple is so advanced, the teacher is so advanced, right? So he was talking about the Gita and this particular work, and he was saying that it is very, very pure Advaita, it is purest form of wisdom. And in the context of that discussion, he was explaining about how he once met one very sincere sadhaka whose guru had explained to him the Ashtavakra Gita and initiated him into the study of the Ashtavakra Gita. So this sadhaka comes and tells him, he said, oh, this is the ultimate and this is the greatest thing. This is the greatest form of wisdom. I have wasted so much time on the rituals and worship when the truth is such, when the truth is so simple and straightforward. I don't know why I spent so much time in all my rituals and the meditations and japa and dhyana and all of that. So this monk asks the sadhaka, but who taught you the Ashtavakra Gita or who introduced you to the Ashtavakra Gita? He says, my guru. My guru initiated me into it. So then the monk asks him, so does your guru perform all of these sadhanas of, seva or japa, dhyana and all of those things? And then the sadhaka says, yes, my guru has been doing all of these for decades together and he still diligently follows all of this. And then the monk asks him, do you think that your guru understands the essence of the Ashtavakra Gita? The sadhaka says, of course, he's a very, very great jnani and because of his discourse, I am inspired. So I am sure that he knows. So then this monk says that here is your guru who understands the Ashtavakra Gita and who has probably known it for many, many decades. If he is continuing to do all the sadhana that you are saying is a waste of time, doesn't it occur to you that there is a value for all of that sadhana that the guru has been doing? Right? The reason I was referring to that is the nature of the truth in its purest form. When it is given to a person, it has the nature to unsettle the person. So when Krishna says Buddhir Vedam, don't unsettle the discrimination of a person who is a karma sangina, who is attached to action, is because when it is given in the purest form, the mind is not prepared to receive it. Right? So the preparation is karma yoga, the preparation is chitta shuddhi, right? So that is why, just like that sadhaka when confused, we must look at a person who is, as Krishna explained in this verse, is a vidvan yukta. These are two words that Krishna uses. He could have just said vidvan. Vidvan means a wise one or a knowledgeable one. But he says a vidvan yukta. A yukta also means something like a wise one. I mean, if only the word yukta was used, probably we would have translated that also as a wise one. But Krishna says the person who is a vidvan and yukta should not disturb the mind of a common man. So who is a vidvan and a yukta? The one who has the knowledge and one who is very, very firmly and strongly established in that knowledge. The fact that you and I are God or everything that you see around is divine and there is nothing but divinity, these are all information that we already have. It has been given to us. We have read it from books. We have heard it from Swami. We speak of it day after day. But these are all information that we have. But one who is a vidvan yukta is one who has the knowledge and one who is very, very steadily established in that knowledge. Such a person will never do something which disturbs the mind of another person. Right? So why is an ajnani or an unwise person likely to err in this manner? Why should the mind be so disturbed? Why should the inaction of a jnani mislead a person in this manner? I think that is a question which is still not adequately answered. How is that the inaction of an ajnani? How is the inaction of an ajnani different from the inaction of a jnani? The verses that are going to follow gives a little bit of hint on this particular question. Why is it that the inaction of an Ajnani is so much more dangerous, and so much Krishna is speaking about it? So we'll listen to the next verse, the verse number 27, and we'll discuss about that a little more deeper into the concept with the next two verses, but we'll go into that now.
Prakrute kriyamanani gunaih karmani sarvashah ahankara vimudhatma karta hamiti manyate.
While actions are being done in every way by the gunas of nature, one who is deluded by egoism thinks thus, I am the doer. So that's verse number 27. There are many, many deep explanations for the shloka, because in this Krishna is referring to the gunas, the sattva, rajas and tamas. What does he mean by prakriti? When he says gunas, does that mean anything else? Because Krishna has not yet introduced the concept of the gunas in detail, which is going to come later in the Gita itself. And then he says, ahankara vimudhatma, one who is deluded by atma. And many such concepts are being discussed here. I will try to give a very simple explanation for this particular shloka based on whatever is the flow of the discussion here, and of course based on some of the explanations that many bhashyakaras have given. The concept of the gunas, as I said, will be explained in a later chapter, and I'm sure we'll be dwelling much more deeper into that. But there has already been, I think, a couple of references to the gunas here, and I think I can be sure that most of the listeners will be familiar or aware about the concept of the gunas. In case some of them are not familiar, probably I'll start with a very, very brief and limited explanation of what the gunas are. There are three gunas, sattva, rajas and tamas. Divinity is referred to as purusha, and the creation is referred to as prakriti. I think this is all Vedanta 101, if I could put it that way, because it's all basis of Vedanta. So the three gunas, sattva, rajas and tamas. Then there is divinity, which is purusha, and there is creation, which is prakriti. It is said that what we refer to as creation or prakriti is nothing but a combination of these three gunas. And in these gunas, the sattva guna is referred to as a pure impulse. The rajoguna or rajas is the quality that represents restlessness, or quality that represents activity. And tamoguna or tamas represents sloth or inertia. Now, in the spiritual path, the sattva guna is given a lot of importance, because through sattva, or through noble and pure nature, we are meant to maintain a balance of all these three gunas. That is, we are meant to use the rajoguna and tamoguna when it is meant to be used. And that can be done when one is focused on the sattva guna. And Swami would often say that these three gunas, sattva, rajas and tamas, are like three chains. Tamoguna is like an iron chain, rajas is like a copper chain, and sattva is like a golden chain. Yes, in our minds, the gold seems to be more lucrative than the others, but they're all chains nevertheless. So Swami would say, even sattva, though is spoken of as greater than rajas and tamas, is also a chain that binds. The reason why Swami would say that is, even though sattva is noble, it also has to be transcended. So one of the ways of describing the spiritual path succinctly in one line would be to say that it is the path where the three gunas are maintained in balance, and then eventually all three of them are transcended. Right? This is probably the best description of the spiritual path, using the three gunas. So if we were to describe the spiritual path in this manner, a jnani, or one who has reached the goal in this process, is said to be a person who has transcended the three gunas. What happens when the gunas are not in balance? Well, we should not be worried about that, because we just have to look at ourselves, and we are all examples of people whose gunas are not in perfect balance. What happens is, I might be lethargic where I'm supposed to be active. I might be overactive where I'm supposed to be passive, maybe. Or I might be overactive, the best example would be like the teenagers of today. Sleep when you're supposed to be awake, and be awake and party when you're supposed to be asleep. So there is a complete mismatch and disharmony in all of these three gunas. In fact, we had done a couple of discussions on the afternoon satsang as to how Swami was making us or giving us an opportunity to balance and harmonize the three gunas through the schedule that he had given for the hostels. And we had seen Swami explains how the day can be broken up into different quarters, and each quarter represents one guna. The early morning time is one period of sattva guna. During the day, it is a period of rajas. Then there is another period of sattva guna, and then there is a period of tamo guna. And Swami would say that those activities have to be done in such a manner that you're doing the sattvic activity during the sattva guna time. You're doing an activity where you're giving rest to the body and the mind, that is sleeping, during the tamo guna time. So going back to the idea of imbalance in the gunas, it is said that it is this imbalance that makes us desire, crave, fear, avoid things, etc., etc. All of this comes because of an imbalance of these gunas. In other words, they form the basis for whatever karma that we are performing. Because that's what we've been seeing all through. Karma is inspired by all of these things. You want to achieve something, you want to become something, you want to avoid something, you don't like something, you do something to keep yourself away from that. So all actions are, in a sense, coming out of all of these emotions of anger, desire, craving, or whatever. And these, in turn, are caused by the imbalance of these three gunas, sattva, rajas, and tamas. So in all of us, it is the gunas or the imbalance in the gunas that are making us act constantly. But if you look at a jnani is one who has transcended the gunas. Now, when we speak of the jnani's actions, someone who has transcended the three gunas, there are two ways of looking at the jnani's actions. One of it is there is no imbalance, and in the absence of any imbalance, there is no craving, there is no anger, there is no greed, any of the other emotions that we associate with a person who is not knowledgeable, like you and me. We all are given to some of these emotions. Because there is no imbalance of the gunas in the jnani, because he has transcended the gunas, there is no sighting of these qualities in the jnani which inspire him to act. The other way of looking at the gunas, the relationship of the gunas with the jnani is something which we'll come to in the discussion of the next verse. So we'll keep it to that. So when we look at a jnani, there is no imbalance. So there is no desire to fulfill. There is no point to make. There is no reaction. There is no anger to express. So probably he can choose to be inactive, right? That's what we've been speaking now. He can choose to be active or he can choose to be inactive. But when seeing that inaction, if one who has not transcended the gunas tries to imitate that inaction, the person's inaction will be born out of an imbalance where the tamo guna is on the higher side. Or maybe even sattva guna, the pious activity comes up. That is also possible. But I recall this is one of the very, very sane advices given by one of my seniors during my student days. He said you should be very, very careful being in an ashram or being in a setup like this or being in Swami's institutions, because he said there is always this danger of confusing the tamo guna with the sattva guna. You might be thinking that you're being very noble, but you might be just being lazy or be avoiding action, Right? So the point I'm making is, here is a jnani who has transcended the gunas, whose actions are not being propelled by the imbalance of the gunas. But if I were to see this person and I say that even I want to be inactive like this person, or I want to be lethargic, or I want to be laid back, or I want to be a sannyasi like that person, the problem is, since I have not transcended the gunas, my imitation might just as well be another expression of the imbalance in my gunas. And what is worse than not doing your duty? Not doing your duty and thinking that it is noble and spiritual. So that is the danger that a person who is an ajnani, who can see a jnani's inaction and get misled by that. And I feel in this verse, Krishna refers to this particular concept that I explained till now. So when he talks about doership, Krishna is speaking about doership here, but this doership is slightly different from the concept of kartritva, the doership which Krishna has been speaking about so far. Because he says, prakritehe gunaihi, of the gunas of prakriti or gunas of nature, kriyamanani karmani sarvashah, are all the actions performed by everyone. So this is a reference to regular karma, that all of us who are doing actions day in and day out, in the course of our everyday activities, all the things that we do, they are all born out of prakritehe gunaihi. The gunas, which are an aspect of creation, as I said, prakriti is what creation is referred to as, and this prakriti is being kept active or kept going because of the gunas. So prakritehe gunaihi, it is because of these that we are doing kriyamanani karmani sarvashah, all the actions that are being performed by everyone. So one has to understand this, that all actions that we are performing are nothing but an expression of the imbalance of the gunas. We are not in control of our actions, and there is a process to be followed. Right? That's the most important acknowledgement that we all have to come to do, that we are right now not in control of our actions. Our actions are being propelled by something else which is beyond our control. And when we acknowledge that, and then we can look for the process by which we can gain the control and then do the right thing. Krishna goes on to say, ahankara vimudhatma karta aham iti manyate. Ahankara vimudhatma. But those that are deluded by the ego, those that are unwise, karta aham iti manyate, they think that I am the doer. So my understanding is that Krishna is saying the gunas are forcing you to act. Even when you choose inaction, it is again the gunas that are compelling you to take that decision, whether to act or whether to not act. Both of these are being inspired by the gunas. And this is the fact that we miss to acknowledge. We think that I am making this choice. I am angry and so I am shouting. You know, I am unhappy and so I am saying this. I am craving for this and so I am wanting this. Krishna is saying that you don't realize that all of this is because of prakritehe gunaihi. It is because of the gunas which are there in the prakriti. But you are being deluded by the ahankara or the ego. And because of that, you are thinking that you are making these choices. You are not in control of yourself. And that's why I said, when Krishna is talking about doership, it's slightly different. He's not referring to the atma or the self being the doer. He's referring to this process of prakriti which is making you do, and you think that you are in control in your doing. It is almost like, I always like to give this example. It's a very strong imagery in my mind. When we were small children and when we were taken on a bike ride by some of the elders in the family, say an uncle or an elder cousin, they would often take us and, you know, put us on the fuel tank of the bike. And we would reach out and hold the handlebar, and we would be going through traffic, and we would, you know, if you were to look at the face of that child, there would be all the contortions which goes with maneuvering through the traffic. All the while when the person who was actually sitting behind is driving the bike. So similarly, in such a manner, we are going through life thinking that I'm getting angry and I am reacting and I am desiring for this and I am working towards this. Krishna is saying that no, these are all the vrittis of prakriti, the gunas of prakriti, which are making you do all of this. It is because you're deluded, you think that you're in control. So that's why I said this doership, which Krishna is referring to here, probably is slightly different. So he's saying, and as Krishna has mentioned many, many times before, and we've discussed, as long as the ahankara is not sublimated, action or inaction, dharma or sannyasa, it is all the decision or the choice the ego is making, right? It is not that, it is not the naishkarmya that we're talking of the jnanis. So the ajnani is still being a puppet in the hands of gunas, but he thinks that he is in control. He says, karta aham. He thinks that I am the doer, iti manyate. He thinks thus. But that is not true. This may or may not be the right explanation for the shloka, but this I feel is what is Krishna hinting at, because this, as I said, this shloka is discussed in much, much detail, because each of these words which Krishna uses, prakriti and guna, the word guna, as we can see, itself is used in different contexts. But I feel this is what the flow of discussion suggests. So if any of you think that the explanation that I've given for this particular verse is not right, or there's a better explanation for that, I think you should feel free to write to me and educate me on that. I'm open to learning. But this is what I feel is the flow in which the discourse is coming. And this explanation that Krishna is giving does not end with here. The next verse also continues with that. So we'll listen to verse number 28 and we'll discuss that also. And we'll see where this discussion is going.
Tattva vittu mahabaho gunakarma vibhagayo guna guneshu vartanta iti matvana sajjate.
But who mighty armed Arjuna, he who realizes the principle that the constituents as also actions are both different from himself, and that all this is nothing but the mutual interplay of the constituents, does not become attached to it. So that's verse number 28, and as you can see, the meaning of that verse itself is a little confusing. There's this story that I'd come across sometime back, or it may not necessarily be a story. I think it's a true life interaction, where there's this interaction between a great jnani who was also an Advaitic master and a sadhaka who had come to see him. So these disciples who were interested in listening to the discourse would always gather at his home and they would sit around him. This was a simple man. He had, you know, he had attracted sadhakas to him because of his wisdom. But he was leading a very simple life. He was sitting there. So the master was giving this discourse on how we are not the body and how we are not the mind, and, you know, a typical discourse on pure Vedanta. So the master is sitting there. The disciples are all sitting around. And as he is giving this discourse, sometime later, somebody comes and gives him water. He drinks it. After some time, somebody offers him food. He eats it. Probably some tea or coffee also comes along and he drinks it. So seeing the scene and listening to the discourse, and then the master says, if any of you have any questions, you might ask me. So one of the disciples who is sitting there, a very sincere sadhaka, looks at the guru and says, Guruji, the few hours that we've been here, we've seen you drink water, we've seen you drink tea, we've seen you probably even taking a small nap and coming, we've also seen you eating food. And probably you've taken he must have taken breaks to ease himself also. So he's referring to all of these regular processes that we all do for our body. And he says, we've seen you do all of this. Are you not like any of us? Are you not doing everything like eating, sleeping and easing yourself and all of that? Just like any of us. How do you say that you are not the body? How do you say that you... Because he's speaking in the highest Advaitic terms by saying that I am the super consciousness, I am not this body. So he says, how do you say that? Because when I look at you, you're doing everything exactly the same way how I would probably do. So the master smiles and says something very, very beautiful. He says, isn't it you who thinks that I am doing all these things? He says, you are seeing me drink water. You are seeing me sleep. You are seeing me eat. Isn't it you who is thinking that I am doing all of these things? But for me, I am not even for a moment deluded that I am doing these things. It's a very, very beautiful answer that the guru gives. You are sitting in front of this jnani, and this jnani is drinking water, he's sleeping, he's eating food, and in my mind I'm thinking that this person is drinking, this person is sleeping, this person is doing all of these things. So the master says, it is in your mind that you're thinking that the guru is sleeping, the guru is eating, but in my mind, not for a moment am I thinking that I am sleeping, I am eating, I am drinking. And the master says, the body thirsts, the body drinks water. The body tires, the body sleeps. I have nothing to do with it. I am the eternal Atma. So a true jnani may do everything like you and me, but he is not even for a moment ahankara vimudhatma. Not even for a moment he is deluded to think that he is doing all of these things. He is not deluded by the ego into thinking that whatever actions that are that he is performing, that he is, whatever actions the body is performing are the actions that he is performing. He doesn't attribute actions, the feelings that propel those actions, and thus even the consequences of those actions to himself. So when we look at a jnani, we are always looking at it from the delusion with which we look at ourselves, right? And that's the basis of this beautiful episode, where the disciple is not able to see from the level at which the master is. So in this particular verse, Krishna compares a deluded person with the jnani. Or rather, he spoke of the action and inaction of an unwise person in the previous one. And here he speaks of the action and inaction of a jnani or a wise person. In the previous verse he said, the guna or the attributes decide the actions and inactions, but the person thinks that he has chosen to act or he has chosen to give up action. Here Krishna says, tattvavit tu, but the tattvavit. He is using a very beautiful word here. He says, tattvavit, tattvavit tu. But the tattvavit, the word tattvavit is again can be broken up into two words, tattva and vit. The word tattva is something that we've discussed in detail. It literally means the thatness of everything. The word tat is a pronoun like that. And what is a pronoun? What is the function of a pronoun? I can use a pronoun like, say, he. I can use it for somebody who is 90 years old. I can use it for somebody who is 9 months old. I can use it for someone who is an Indian. I can use it for someone who is an American. Which means a pronoun itself is something which can be used irrespective of name and form and all the other attributes. So when we say tattva, it means the thatness of everything. If there is an object in front of you, there is a person in front of you, if you were to strip that object and person of the name and form, what remains is the thatness. And Vedanta says the thatness of everything is one and the same. The thatness of the mountain, the thatness of you, the thatness of the sun, the thatness of this entire universe is one and the same. Right? So that's the concept of Vedanta. So that is what is referred to as tattva, the thatness of things. And we've seen Krishna refer to the word tattva darshibhihi. Sometime in the second chapter, he says, the one who sees this tattva all the time. That's again a reference to a jnani. Sometime later, there is going to be the usage of another word. Tattva jnanis is another word that Krishna will use. Here he uses the word tattvavit, the one who has the knowledge of that tattva. So it is again a reference of a jnani, but different ways of explaining that same, the wise person. So he says, tattvavit tu mahabaho, O Arjuna, the mighty armed one. But the tattvavit, the wise who know the truth, who know the tattva, guna karma vibhaga yoho, know that they are distinct from karma and the gunas that propel them. Guna karma vibhaga yoho. They know that there is a difference between these guna karmas, the gunas which propel and the karmas which are performed. They know that they are distinct from them. They don't identify with the actions or the impulses. He goes on to say, guna guneshu vartanta. Guna guneshu vartante. The gunas engage with the objects of the gunas. Because, as I said, the word guna is used in many, many contexts. It can be used as a synonym for many things. And one of the things it can be used for is senses. So guna guneshu actually could be even said to be senses and the sense objects, or senses and those which are interacted with through the senses. Because if you look at it, the senses are nothing but an physical expression of these gunas, or the imbalance of the gunas, right? And that is why when Krishna says guna guneshu, it could mean the gunas and the objects which can be interacted with through the gunas, or the physical objects which are around you, which are also prakriti in nature. Or it can also mean the sense and the sense objects. So this pair of words, guna guneshu, it would not be wrong in saying that it is sense and sense objects, and many, many commentators and people who explain also use this meaning for this particular complex word. So when Krishna says guna guneshu vartanta, it can mean that the senses that are essentially driven by the gunas dwells on the objects that are also a manifestation of these gunas. The prakriti body interacts with the prakriti creation, the prakriti world outside us, right? But he does not identify himself with the body or that with which the body interacts. So everything in this physical world is referred to as a vritti, or a modification of these gunas. So Krishna says the jnani remains a witness even as the senses indulge in the sense objects. So when I said earlier, a jnani is somebody who is beyond the gunas, or beyond the imbalance of the gunas, the imbalance of the gunas do not cause him to act. That is one way of looking at the jnani. And the other way of looking at the jnani is, he does not interfere with the gunas and their interaction with the guneshu, or the objects of the gunas in the outside world. Just like how I spoke about that great master who says, when the body is thirsty, which is again an aspect of guna of the body, it interacts with the outside world in the way of drinking water. When the body requires tamas, when the body requires rest, it is given that rest. Not for a moment a jnani thinks that he is sleeping, he is eating, he is acting. He remains completely above that level. He is always only a witness to what happens to the body and with the body. Right? So he says, guna guneshu vartanta. The senses that are based on the gunas interact with the sense objects that are also based on the gunas. But a jnani knows, guna karma vibhaga yoho, that he is different from the whole process of gunas and their interaction with the objects. So he says, iti matva, having known this, na sajjate, he can remain unattached. So when the Advaitic master said, you see me eat, you see me drink, it means because the observer is not established in the truth, the observer is not a tattvavid, that the individual is not the body, he is looking at the master and saying that you are acting normally. But the jnani himself is not deluded even for a moment to think that he is drinking, he is sleeping, or he is doing all of these actions. But there's a difference in the way the person will act. Though the actions are the same, though the jnani and the ajnani seem to be doing the same thing, there will be a slight difference in the way they act, and that is what will become the example for the ajnani. And what Krishna keeps repeating again and again is, na sajjate, without attachment. The person will act, but will act without attachment. And that detached action becomes an example. This is one important point that you can see Krishna reiterating again and again. Yes, the wise one is unattached. Yes, the wise is satisfied in himself. For this person, action and inaction mean one and the same. There's nothing that he needs and everything is, he's happy all the time. He's self-satisfied. And all of these descriptions that Krishna keeps giving for the jnani. But one thing that we have to keep in mind is all of these are only expressions of his wisdom. The wisdom itself is not based on any of these traits. All of these traits are nothing but an expression of that wisdom. So the fundamental trait or the fundamental wisdom is, first of all, being someone who sees only the tattva, only the truth, the essence of everything that is seen around. And the other thing is never to be away from that knowledge that he or she is not the prakriti, but the person is indeed the Paramatma. There's a very beautiful interaction between Swami and a devotee, and I'm sure I must have mentioned this in the other shows, where there was this devotee who was sitting in Swami's presence, probably in the interview room, and was asking Swami this question, that Swami, you keep saying that everybody is divine, you're also divine, and whatever you see is divine. He said, I'm not able to understand it, Swami. I am an individual who's going through life with all of these problems. How do I come to terms with this fact that you're saying that I am divine? And Swami gives this very beautiful example. Swami points to the bulb in the room and Swami says, look at that bulb. The bulb is glowing, right? And Swami says, there are two things that make that bulb glow. One is the bulb itself and the other is the unseen current which is making that bulb glow. So Swami said, you are like that glowing bulb. Right now, you are thinking that you are the bulb which can be seen. All that I am saying is, you're not the bulb, but you're the current which is making that bulb glow. And Swami said, that's all is the difference. There's nothing more to that. So Swami is saying that you have this body which is prakriti. You have this entire world which is also prakriti, which is all and nothing but an interaction of the gunas. All of this is all around you, but there is something which is animating it. There is the Paramatma or the Purusha behind this prakriti which is animating it. Right now, here I am sitting in front of you, in front of the microphone, I'm speaking. So there is this physical body which is speaking, which is like that bulb, but there is something which is animating this body from within. And Swami said, all that I'm saying is right now you think that you're this body. All I'm saying is you're not the body, but you're the Purusha which is animating this body. That's all is the difference. So the wisdom of a tattvavit may express in many ways, may express in calmness, may express in detachment, may express in wise words, might give a very beautiful discourse and all of that. If it expresses as a karma, the reason why that could be a mis... Krishna says that that could be a misleading example. But when it expresses as karma, then the people will be able to see that here is the person who is not touched by loss. Here is a person who is so detached. Here is a person who is always happy and he is doing all his duty diligently. So the person will be observed and say that what is it that this person has that I do not have? And Krishna says that the unwise person will see such a person and try to do their duty with a similar amount of detachment, which is nothing but an expression of this fundamental idea that I am not this body, but I am the Purusha that animates this Prakriti body. So that is why Krishna keeps repeating that, because we must not forget that all of these are traits of a jnani. Right? These are all only expressions of that wisdom, but the wisdom itself is not being deluded that I am the body. And to receive that, the mind has to be prepared. And for the mind to be prepared, the path is through buddhi. And that's why Krishna says the path is to constantly make this choice between prayas and shreyas all through your life. And even when there are temptations in front of you, and that itself will lead you to that vairagya, or this feeling that I'm not interested in the benefit. And the moment the individual transcends this desire for what is it that I will benefit by doing this action, you're without your knowledge, you have been, it's like when you're going in a train, you don't even realize that you have changed the track. It happens so smoothly. So without your knowledge from karma, the bogey will just shift to Karma Yoga, and as you're going, Krishna says that the mind gets prepared to receive the truth. So till that happens, a jnani should not disturb an ajnani. It is not because a jnani benefits if an ajnani remains an ajnani. It is not in that sense. So with that, dear listeners, I think we'll have to wind up this week's program. If you have anything to share, as I said, if you do not agree with what I said, if you feel that there is a better explanation or there's something that I missed out, feel free to write to me, and definitely if I find that useful for all our listeners, I would be glad to share it on the show. As always, you can write to listener@radiosai.org, or you can write to me personally. You're free to do that, prem@radiosai.org, or you can also send us your feedback through our WhatsApp number. I'll join you all again next week for the resumption of the Triune Pilgrimage. We still have, I think, a few more verses in the third chapter to complete. So we will be continuing with the Karma Yoga. Do join me again next week at 7:30 PM. Till then, take care. Jai Sairam.
Thursday Live. Stay tuned.